Hi, this is John Hartcher, and welcome to episode 33 of Keep On Grooving. We're up to part three of our look at Eric Clapton's career in the 1966 to 1970 time frame. Now we're up to early 1970. He's just finished doing his solo record and was looking for something else to do. He was able to play with one of his blues heroes, played on his best friend's epic album, fell in love with his wife, and then came up with his own band under a sort of alias. And as luck would have it, he crossed paths with another of the generation's greatest guitarists and came up with a masterpiece. Looked like everything was going great, until it wasn't. Episode 33, Eric Clapton, 1970. The Howlin' Wolf London Sessions, All Things Must Pass, and Derek and the Dominoes. Okay, we are definitely going to finish this today, no matter how long it takes to wrap up. We left off with Eric Clapton finishing up his solo record with Delaney and Bonnie's band. They did a few more appearances together, and things just kind of fell apart. We mentioned last time Leon Russell was working with Joe Cocker on his second album. The two of them had their own idea of going out with a group of friends to do a big, expansive show with a big, expansive band. So who better to get than the friends from Delaney and Bonnie, since they were out of work? So the basis of what became Mad Dogs and Englishmen was that band, with the exception of Eric and Bobby Whitlock. They recorded the shows at the end of March at Fillmore East, both on tape and on film. One of the songs performed was Groupie, a.k.a. Superstar, this time performed by Rita Coolidge. Now, though Rita didn't directly work with Eric again, she will make an appearance later on as the possible co-author of his most famous song. Many of these same people also went to go to work with Dave Mason on his first solo album, Alone Together. The album opens with his own version of Only You Know and I Know, more guitar-driven than the Delaney and Bonnie version. The last song in the album, Look at Me, Look at You, was co-written by his former Traffic bandmate Jim Capaldi. There were rumors flying around to this day that Eric actually played the final guitar solo on the album, but Mason has said a number of times Eric didn't play anything on the album at all. If you listen to the Delaney and Bonnie concerts, some of the same guitar phrases turn up there as well as on this album, and it's definitely not Eric doing those. Sometimes guitar players have favorite phrases. Jimmy had his, Clapton does a whole thing about phrases he likes to use in the Cream Farewell Show. So those are definitely Dave. Soon after his album recording was done, Clapton took part in a multi-artist jam called Summit Meeting. It was supposed to be a big album for Atlantic, but both Clapton and Jeff Beck's managers didn't want their names on the album. It finally snuck out in 1972 with little fanfare. Once he was done with Delaney and Bonnie, Eric headed to London and went back to playing on any number of sessions by various artists. He played on the entire record of Taj Mahal guitarist Jesse Ed Davis, his first solo album. He also possibly appears on Ringo Starr's first hit, It Don't Come Easy, but he may be buried in the mix. His buddy Stephen Stills was recording his own solo record, as were all the other guys in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Eric contributed to two songs, Go Back Home and Fishes and Scorpions. The first one made the 1970 album. The second came out on Stephen Stills 2 a year later. Now, Jimmy also contributed to Stephen Stills' first solo album, playing the solo on Old Times, Good Times. And it's interesting to compare Eric and Jimmy's work on the songs. Eric's is a fiery solo at the end, which would fit right in with what he was playing later in the year. Jimmy's playing is more understated, but would also fit right in with what he would end up doing at the Electric Lady session. It's just where their heads were at during that time. Eric also did some sessions for Dr. John for a projected triple album that ended up just being a single LP, The Sun, the Moon, and Herbs. It's well known that American blues artists made a deep impression on the British music scene, Eric being a prime example. The mixing of these two worlds didn't always work out so well. As we mentioned, the Yardbirds did a number of appearances with Chess artist Sonny Boy Williamson. It was an eye-opener to the young men, to be sure. A far more successful combination of an older artist and younger musicians was the Muddy Waters 1969 album Fathers and Sons. Muddy was joined by Mike Bloomfield and Paul Butterfield, among others. They did a studio album and a live album, redoing a lot of old favorites from Mr. Morganfield's catalog. The last song in the album, a reprise of Got My Mojo Working, features the unmistakable backbeat of Mr. Buddy Miles. So the idea arose to have Muddy's semi-rival and counterpart at Chess, Howlin' Wolf, do his own album like this. Now, Mr. Burnett had already done a few albums with younger modern players, and they hadn't worked out so well. The 1968 Howlin' Wolf album had this printed right there on the cover. This is Howlin' Wolf's new album. He doesn't like it. Boy, if that doesn't make you want to take it up to the register, get it home, and toss it on the turntable, I don't know what else does. One of the guitarists on that album, Pete Cozy, made a lot of noise on later albums with Miles Davis. It's his thing and he does it very well. It just doesn't go with Howlin' Wolf. But Chess still wanted to get the Wolf in with some younger artists and have it turn out the way Muddy's did. One of their producers had talked to Eric about possibly doing an album back during the Cream days. Finally, in May 1970, the schedule worked out and Chester was sent over to London. Now, originally balked at sending Wolf's longtime guitarist Hubert Sumlin over as well, but Eric insisted he be part of it or else it was off. So Hubert came as well. They originally planned to have a bass band, Eric, the Rolling Stones rhythm section of Bill Wyman and Charlie Watts, and occasionally Ian Stewart, as well as harmonica player Jeff Karp, who'd been on Fathers and Sons, work with Wolf and Sumlin and redo many of his old Chess classics. But on the first day, Bill and Charlie couldn't make it. So they quick rang up a couple of replacements, Klaus Voormann on bass and Ringo Starr on drums. Only if you look at the original album, you see the name Richie. Apparently, they were worried about having a Beatles name right there in the credits, so they came up with something else. Once the original sessions were done, the tapes were sent over to Chess Records in Chicago, and overdubs were done by Phil Upchurch on bass and Lafayette Leak on piano, as well as a horn section on some tracks. Also joining in was Steve Winwood on organ, at that point on tour in the U.S. with a revived Traffic. The original album consists of 12 tracks, well, 12 and a half of sorts. Side one kicks off with Rockin' Daddy, followed by I Ain't Superstitious, the one with Klaus and Ringo. Sitting on Top of the World was next. We know Eric knew that one. Word About My Baby followed. Then came a song called What a Woman. If you know Stevie Ray Vaughan's Live Alive album, you'll immediately recognize this as Commit a Crime, a song Wolf did in 1966. Side one ends with Poor Boy. Side two begins with Built for Comfort and Who's Been Talking. Then there's a little bit of studio chatter where Wolf tries to show the boys how they should play Little Red Rooster, a song Bill and Charlie knew well since they took it to number one with the Stones back in 1964 in England. But the way Wolf wanted it done was sort of off the beat and showed them on the acoustic guitar. It sort of reminds me of something I think I mentioned, how Billy Cox described how he and Jimmy played, you know. We didn't play by notes on the stand, you know, we played by feel. So that's kind of what Wolf wanted to do. It's like one, two, not quite right on the beats, just off, but just going with the feel of it. Eric then asked Howlin' Wolf why he didn't just play along with them on a song, and Bill and Charlie chimed in agreement. But the final recording just has Wolf on vocals. The album ended with Do the Do, Highway 49, and Wang Dang Doodle. There were three other tracks recorded for the album that didn't make it out until 1974 on an album entitled London Revisited. It featured four songs from Muddy Waters' later London sessions that didn't make it onto that record on side one, and the three Howlin' Wolf songs on side two. The three were Going Down Slow, and I Want to Have a Word with You with Klaus and Ringo, done on May 2nd, and Killin' Floor from the last day of the sessions on May 7th. The deluxe edition from 2003 included the original album, the three extra tracks, an entire alternate album, which had alternate takes of each song from the original album with the exception of Wang Dang Doodle. Charlie Records put out their own alternate album with other alternate takes, so there's just a boatload of them out there. As for Muddy, there's only the original London Session album out there. London Revisited, to the best of my knowledge, has not been digitally reissued anywhere, and the other four Muddy tracks haven't been issued anywhere else separately as well. Streaming, MCA, streaming! The London Sessions concept was extended to two more Chess artists, Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry. Berry's actually resulted in his only number one song on the Billboard Hot 100, My Ding-a-Ling. Remember that thing I was saying about suggestive song lyrics? And as Eric was doing all of his session work, Bobby Whitlock showed up and the two started jamming together. Later, Carl Radle and Jim Gordon came over as the Joe Cocker tour had ended. Eric had wanted to put a band together to go and play songs from his solo album, and this would be the perfect opportunity to see if they could make it work. And it turns out they didn't even need to go out on tour. They became the house band for one of the most anticipated albums of the year. 1970 was the year the Beatles broke up and pop music was changed forever. So each of the four went off to do their own thing. Ringo already started down his own path with George's help on It Don't Come Easy. John had made a few albums with Yoko and would work on his own album. Paul didn't work with anyone immediately, other than Linda. He did his first solo album practically all by himself. George, however, took the exact opposite approach. He brought in everyone under the sun to play on his sessions. His album would have friends like Klaus and Ringo and Billy Preston. He had Gary Brooker from Procol Harum. He had another younger Gary on keyboards, Gary Wright, he of later Dreamweaver fame. Peter Frampton says he played on the album, but nobody's quite sure which song. Another young player added percussion to one track, I think The Art of Dying. Later that year, he ended up behind the drum kit of an up-and-coming band named Genesis, namely Phil Collins. But the house band, for lack of a better word, was George's buddies from the Delaney and Bonnie days. The core of Eric, Bobby, Carl, and Jim would be augmented by Dave Mason, Bobby Keys, and Jim Price. For the next 2 months, they worked on a wide variety of songs. The band worked on a group of the album's most famous songs, Wawa, Isn't That a Pity, version one, What is Life, Run of the Mill, Beware of Darkness, Awaiting on You All, and the future number one, My Sweet Lord. The band was having such a good time, they ended up adding a whole album to an already full double album. Almost the entirety of the Apple Jam bonus album, with the exception of It's Johnny's Birthday and Thanks for the Pepperoni, was this band. All of this ended up as the three-record set, All Things Must Pass. During the session, the guys gave themselves a name, Derek and the Dominoes. Eric sort of wanted to hide away from his previous image and just go out and play. Plus, Eric and Bobby had been writing a number of songs together, so they decided to record a single with George's producer, a guy named Phil Spector. First was a really fast number, Tell the Truth. The B-side had the four of them joined by George and Dave Mason on a number called Roll It Over. It's another song about a guy who really likes a girl and, well, let your imagination run wild on this. You're probably not wrong. Now, in hindsight, this one is a little uncomfortable seeing who played on it and considering what or who it may be about. Turns out Eric fell in love with a model named Patty Boyd. One slight complication, she just so happened to be George Harrison's wife at the time. So George is off making the album. Eric's trying to make time with Mrs. Harrison. Eric decided at one point to tell her she should really leave George and go run off with him. Patty turned him down cold, and he seemed surprised she didn't go. That's when Eric started turning his attention in another direction, and not a good one. Drugs had been prevalent in the mid to late 60s. Marijuana gave way to cocaine and LSD, then for some on up to heroin. Everyone thought it was all a good time until the victims of the lifestyle started turning up. By 1970, they thought it was all just part of being a rock star. Derek and the Dominoes did a short tour of England with Dave Mason joining them for their first show at the Lyceum, then heading off on his own again before heading back to traffic, then heading off on his own again. But he did give kind of a rationale for the Derek part of the name. D for Dave added to Eric. Now, remember that calculation. Eric's love life was a bit despondent, but it was a boon to songwriting. He and Bobby went on a tear, rattling off a whole bunch of songs. They would also tag team on vocals, patterning themselves after Sam and Dave. With all of that in mind, four of them picked up and headed down to Criteria Studios in Miami with Tom Dowd and a lot of heroin. Didn't always make for the best of recording circumstances, if you thought Jimmy's parties in the studio weren't conducive to a good recording atmosphere, a bunch of catatonic guys weren't that great either. But when they were on, things were gelling well. As opposed to the other guitar heroes of the era, for this album, Clapton opted against the wall of Marshall's approach. Instead, he recorded his Strat through a little pig-nose amp around the size of a little ceramic heater. Certainly gave it a unique sound. The only other guitar I can really ever remember hearing with this particular sound is on Speaking Out by Neil Young off of Tonight's the Night. I'm pretty sure it's Nils Lofgren's guitar. While they were in Miami, Tom mentioned he'd just done some work with the Allman Brothers Band. Eric perked up and said, "Oh, you mean that guy who did solo on Wilson Pickett's Hey Jude?" and proceeds to wail off Duane Allman's solo. Dowd said they'd be in town, they should go. The night of the show, Tom and Eric go there and get seats right down in the front. The band comes on, Duane's playing. He suddenly looks down and sees the two of them right in front, and he totally freezes. Stops right there on stage. Dickie Betts looks over to see what's going on. He sees Tom and Eric himself and immediately turns away. He later said, "I didn't want to get myself distracted." That night, the two bands did at least one big jam loosely based on Killing Floor. Eric asked Duane if he wanted to play on the sessions. Duane said he'd love to. He stuck around for a few days. Then the band had commitments through most of September, but he would be open again in early October. So the Allmans went back on the road while Derek and the Dominoes continued jamming and working on the album. I don't know if it was specifically planned this way or not, but the album generally ended up being recorded in the order it would be released. Or released in the order it was recorded, one or the other. That's why the very first songs on the album don't have Duane on them, despite what one of the studio sheets said. Of course, they did overdubs later, but in essence, this is kind of how it turned out. During the break in recording the album, Eric headed over to London. He hoped he was going to cross paths with Jimmy. Firstly, he picked up a left-handed Stratocaster to give him. Second, he might have wanted to let him know about a tribute his band was doing for him in the form of a cover version. It's unclear if he was planning to meet him at a Sly Stone concert or if he just happened to see him, but in either case, he didn't end up meeting up with him. A few days later, Jimmy was dead, so the tribute soon took on an additional resonance. Duane came back in October, and the band finished up working on the record, which was titled Layla and Other Assorted Love Songs. They had enough for a double album and actually ended up not fitting one completed song on the record. So we'll go over the 14 tracks on the album, the one extra completed song, plus maybe a few more. Then for some of the tracks, we'll talk about the changes that were done when Bill Levinson did a remix of the album for its 20th anniversary in 1990. Side one kicks off with a Clapton Whitlock original, I Looked Away. Lyrically, it sounds like Eric maybe had a shot with Patty early on, but he didn't act on it, so she went off, did her own thing, and now he regrets it. It's a laid-back number. Eric starts off the song, Bobby joins in with the chorus, and then he takes the second bridge, middle eight verse section on his own. Eric then does two counterbalancing solos before a final verse, sung, and a burst of wailing guitar that comes to a quiet end. On the 20th anniversary remix, Bill changes the balance between the two guitars on that middle solo section. Not sure why, maybe just to highlight the other guitar part, but I'd stick to the original. It just sounds like a better balance. Next is Bell Bottom Blues. The story is that Eric got Patty a pair of bell-bottom jeans as a gift, and she absolutely hated them, thought they looked terrible. That's just what a lovesick guy needs to hear. The emotions are really raw in this song, especially during the chorus when both Eric and Bobby reach for high notes they probably shouldn't be able to hit. Now, the weird thing is this song was released as a single that didn't really get anywhere near the top 40, yet I clearly remember hearing the song when I was a kid back in the early to mid 70s and only listening to AM radio, you know, WABC, WNBC, those kind of stations. When I got the album in my Clapton Rush in 1987 and heard this, I distinctly remember, I don't want to fade. I remember that. I'm like, oh, geez, I heard this when I was a kid. Third song on the record is Keep On Growing. This is the first song where the guitar hero soloing really emerges. and there are two killer guitars going back and forth through most of the song. But in this case, they're all Eric. There's a studio sheet with Dwayne's name slated in on track 3, but it's scratched out. From all evidence, it just appears this is a mistake, and Dwayne does not appear on this song at all. But there is one thing that was hidden on the original mix that the 20th anniversary one revealed. Right as the intro comes to an end before the main part of the song starts, Eric lets out a woo, and then the song starts. Some people think it's Bobby, but it's got that gravelly tone in the vocal Eric had for this album. When Eric's later girlfriend, Sheryl Crow, did a cover for this, and I think it was like the Boys on the Side soundtrack, she threw in the yell as well. Eric and Bobby do most of the verse vocals together. Bobby takes the part right before the choruses, and then they both come back in and do the choruses. A cover of the old blues jazz standard Nobody Knows or Loves You When You're Down and Out finishes up the side, and this song is the first where Dwayne Allman joins in. He mostly does slide on the album, and here is no exception. Eric takes his solo, and then Dwayne does his slide part. Eric does the vocals all on his own. A more old-fashioned arrangement of the song ended up on Unplugged 30 years later. Side 2 starts out with an acoustic number, though Dwayne's part is electric, and Jim Gordon does congas instead of the drum kit. It's titled I Am Yours, and the lyrics are from part of Nizami's Story of Layla and Majnun, which is where Eric got the title of the album from. More on that later. The guy pledges his love to a girl no matter what, and everything he does reminds him of her. It's kind of like a 13th century version of Every Breath You Take when you look at it that way. I remember I had to read the story in a college lit class and diligently look for the poem all the way there until I found it. It's about 2/3 of the way through the story and has all but one line included in the song. Next up is Any Day, another one from Eric and Bobby. This one's been compared to a chariot race with Eric and Dwayne racing up and down the guitar neck. The girl he's going after doesn't want to deal with him, but any day he'll see her smile. Isn't that nice? Eric takes the first and third verses, Bobby takes the second, and they both do the lead up and the choruses. For anyone who bought it hoping for some explosive guitar interplay, you get your money's worth here. And there's still more than a full album to go. The first LP ends with a cover of Big Bill Brunzi's Key to the Highway, and it's a song that almost didn't get on tape. At one point, the band started to jam on this song, and they were smoking right off the bat. Tom Dowd looks down and sees the tape machine is not running. He runs over, screams, "Start the effing tape!" It clicks on and starts, which is why the song fades in its start there. It's almost 10 minutes as it is. Who knows how much longer it was. This is the Eric and Dwayne show from beginning to end. They go back and forth, pushing each other higher and higher. And there's still a full album to go. The second record starts with Tell the Truth. This was originally the A-side to their first single done during the All Things Must Pass sessions with Phil Spector producing. That version, as mentioned, was done really fast. So fast it sounds like Bobby had a hard time keeping up with the vocals. Kind of like how Mitch tried to do his drum part to Stepping Stone but didn't quite catch the beat. Or Jimmy doing the runs up the neck at the start of Room Full of Mirrors and nailing it maybe once or twice tops. Once they cut this version, done in a far more leisurely pace, they asked the record company to yank the single. It's another one where Eric does the first and third verses, Bobby takes the second, and they do the choruses together. And this time it sounds like both Dwayne and Eric are on slide, and the song towards the end devolves into a glorious chaos before fading out. The second song on the side is Anything But Leisurely. The title says it all. Why does love gotta be so sad? This one is raw emotion from beginning to end. Tellingly, Eric takes all the verses himself. Bobby joins in on the choruses and does vocal counterpoints throughout. At the same time, Dwayne does guitar counterpoints and takes the bulk of the solos, including a wicked one in the middle. Then as the song begins to wind down, he does a little snippet of Joy to the World that he'd later reprise on Live at Fillmore East towards the end of You Don't Love Me. Maybe they should have done that one here too. If you want to hear five guys completely tuned into each other, this track is the perfect example. It's kind of like the opposite of what Cream was doing. Those were three guys going their own direction. These were five guys all going the same way. The last song on side three is Have You Ever Loved a Woman? It's about a guy who's in love with his best friend's wife. Hard to believe it's not an original, but it's an old blues cover, meaning someone else was in Eric's exact same situation. This is another one where he sings the whole thing by himself. When it gets to the solo section, Dwayne takes a bit of a mournful solo on slide first before Eric unleashes his strat for a savage minute or so. This song stuck around his live set list for most of the 70s, then revived in the 90s when he re-entered his blues phase. Side 4 starts off with the tribute to Jimmy, their cover of Little Wing. As mentioned earlier, the band came up with their own arrangement of the song at their first gigs over the summer, so it was not a last-minute addition after Jimmy died. Once he'd passed, the two guitar gods turned the song into a wailing monument to their fallen friend. Though, I don't think Dwayne ever got a chance to meet him unless they had passed by each other at Atlanta Pop or something like that. Eric and Bobby do the entire song as a duet, singing almost all the lines together. Jimmy's version was a delicately done, quiet number with intricate chord arrangements and a dreamy solo at the end. This one is power chords from beginning to end and wailing vocals. They do drop a couple of lyrics. They leave out moonbeams after fairy tales and the writing with the wind phrase in between the two verses. Next is another cover, this time Chuck Willis's It's Too Late, about a guy who loses a girl. You get the idea that we're going for a theme on this album? Eric does the bulk of the vocals with Bobby doing counterpoint at the choruses. Dwayne takes the slide solo. They definitely did the song live at least once, and everybody had the chance to see it. They recorded four songs for the Johnny Cash show that aired on January 6, 1971, though it was recorded back in November. Two of them made the broadcast, It's Too Late, and a jam between Eric, Johnny, and Carl Perkins on Matchbox. We'll talk about the other two songs that didn't air when we talk about the live album. Now I'm going to do something different. I'm going to jump to the last track, then we'll go back and talk about the title song, so there's a lot to talk about with that one. So the last song on the album is a Bobby Whitlock song, and he does the vocals all on his own, Thorn Tree in the Garden. He writes it about a girl, but it's actually about a dog he had that a supposed friend took away and put to sleep. Wow, at least Shannon went out to see. So it deals with a sense of loss. Bobby has a vivid description of recording this with the band sitting around in a circle. I guess it's a good finish for it, but it's hard to follow one of the greatest songs in rock history when it's at the end. Okay, the big one, the title track, Layla. As we just talked about, the story of Layla and Majnun was about a guy who saw the woman he loved get married to someone else, but he couldn't forget her. Just the kind of thing Eric needed to read at this point. But it inspired him to write a ballad about his own situation. He conceived it as a kind of slow ballad, but when Dwayne heard it, he got another idea. He said, well, you remember that old Albert King song, As the Years Go Passing By, you know, there is nothing I can do. And he started playing a riff based on that little melody there. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So they start to reconstruct the song. Then Dwayne comes up with a high part further down the neck, playing the exact same thing. That's how the song got its classic opening. Eric takes all the vocals himself. After all, it was his life we're listening to. And Bobby would back up on the choruses. When it came to the solo at the end, it was all Dwayne on slide going absolutely wild all the way up and down the neck frantically while Eric and Bobby are wailing in the background. Just pure emotion pouring out of every note for all 3 minutes. But how do you end it? Somewhere along the way, Jim Gordon was sitting behind the piano playing a little number. The rest of the band heard it and he came up with the idea for putting that piano part onto the end of Layla. For that section, Jim did play the piano part as well as the drums on a different track, obviously. Eric only played acoustic guitar on the end section, while Dwayne did all the slide parts on the song. He even came up with a neat ending. He ran the slide all the way up near the pickups and made it sound like little birds flying away. There was just one problem. Jim had forgotten to mention it was actually part of another song he wrote with someone, namely his girlfriend earlier that year, Rita Coolidge. According to her, Jim basically took the song and used it on Layla, even though they had done a demo for it called Time. Now, that song prominently features the second section of the piano part. The intro in Layla is apparently new, but the middle section is clearly patterned on Time. So far, Rita hasn't been given credit for the song. In fact, it was quite a while before Jim was given credit for his part. So the band took two completely different songs and somehow managed to meld them together into one cohesive 7-minute epic. But they weren't done with this one just yet. Someone, maybe Tom Dowd, came up with the idea of speeding it up a little bit, like half a tone. If you were trying to get your guitar to match the sound of the record, you'd basically tune it up not a whole fret, but half of one. I tried it once. It's really strange. The 20th anniversary mix finds something extra in the other tracks. Duane did an entire slide guitar part through the whole first half of the song, not just the little bits during the verses and at the end. He tried to do counterpoint to his own regular soloing. It doesn't quite work, so it's understandable it was mixed down on the final version. But for a bunch of years there in the early 90s, this was the go-to version for WNEW in New York. Once they crashed and burned and disappeared by the end of the decade, everybody went back to the original. They did finish one more song for the album, and like Blind Faith, it might have been a better finish to use this one instead of Thorn Tree, beautiful song that it is. It's a cover of the old Little Walter song, Mean Old World. It's done really old time with Eric and Duane on acoustic slide guitars, not sure if one of them is a dobro or not, and Jim on bass drum only. Since Bobby's not there, Eric does all the vocals himself. The band did record a full version of it with all five of them, but they ended up releasing this one. Only it wasn't on a Derek and the Dominoes or Eric Clapton album. In November 1972, a year after Duane's unfortunate passing, the Duane Allman Anthology came out with a number of previously released and unreleased songs, and this made the cut along with Layla. There was really only one more song that was close to being used, something called Tender Love, but it never got lyrics. Everyone was really proud of this record and the work they'd done. So it came out along with Layla as a single, and both left no ripple on the current scene, almost completely ignored. We'll talk about what the effect of this did to Eric a bit later. So around the same time the Duane Allman album came out in 1972, a best of Eric Clapton album of sorts called The History of Eric Clapton also came out. They decided to try releasing Layla as a single again, this time the whole song. The previous single tried to edit it down to 3 minutes. This time it finally hit, making it all the way to the top 10 in the US. 30 years later, when Eric did his Unplugged album, he decided to strip Layla back down to its original version before Duane added his enhancements. Pete Townsend hated it, called it an effing bossa nova. But the record-buying public disagreed, sending the Unplugged version almost into the top 10 as well, falling just short at number 12. But it was all over MTV and won Grammys galore. The band did a pretty extensive U.S. tour in the fall of 1970, playing all kinds of venues. They were able to have Duane join them a couple of times towards the end, once in Syracuse, the other time in Tampa. They generally played a number of songs from Layla as well as Eric's solo album. They did a few numbers from earlier bands and debuted some new tracks along the way. Unfortunately, a live album didn't make it out until 1973, long after the band broke up. As the sessions were ending for Layla and before the band went back on a tour, Eric joined Buddy Guy and Junior Wells for an album they were doing for Atlantic. After the U.S. tour ended, they went back to England and started to work on a solo album for Bobby. The tracks from these sessions made it out over two records. He then helped out his old band leader, John Mayall, for an album he was doing entitled Back to the Roots. Mayall's band recorded the basic tracks, and Eric came in and did overdubs later. However, some of them didn't turn out so well. You sometimes can't do too many overdubs on these old tapes. So in the 80s, Mayall went back, stripped off a bunch of things, and overdubs other things later, redid it, and released it with some new songs as archives to 80s. So once spring rolled around, it was time to work on the next album. Only things were nowhere near as joyous as the Miami sessions. Yeah, there were a lot of drugs down there, which didn't always make for good sessions. but the results speak for themselves. This time, the band had some songs and a lot of jamming, but it just wasn't coming together. Then the story goes, Eric made some comment about a drummer in another band. Jim Gordon got very ticked off about it, threw his sticks, someone walked out, and the band never played together again. That was that. So instead of finding another outlet, Eric began to fall into the depths of heroin addiction. He hung out at his home in England and barely left it. He did come to New York in August 1971 to play George Harrison's concert for Bangladesh. Despite the fact his best friend tried to steal his wife away from him, George never seemed to hold a grudge about it. Not many guys would be like that. Eric came and played as part of the house band. People noticed he didn't look fully healthy, though nowhere near like he would a year later. His playing during shows was okay. He didn't completely stumble, but it was nowhere near the fire of what he was doing a year earlier. Eric stayed out of the spotlight through almost all of 1972, causing ATCO to go ahead and come up with the aforementioned History of Eric Clapton. It wasn't your typical greatest hits collection. It started out with the B-side to the Yardbirds' second single, I Ain't Got You. Eric gets to do a couple of flashy solos, I guess of the earlier studio songs, this is among the best choices for him. Next is Hideaway from the John Mayall Blues Breakers album. Again, good choice. They could have either gone with All Your Love or Ramblin' on My Mind instead. Now, the third track on the UK album is Tales from Brave Ulysses, but on the US version, it's one of the Jimmy Page tracks, tribute to Elmore. The rest of the first album is filled with Cream songs, Sunshine of Your Love and Crossroads finish side one, and the live version of Spoonful and Badge make up side two. They could have actually fit anyone for tennis on side one and kept it around 22 minutes on the side. Album two is where things come out of left field. Side three starts off with Sea of Joy from Blind Faith. Presence of the Lord would have been a way better choice. The next two are from the Delaney and Bonnie live album, Only You Know and I Know, and I Don't Want to Discuss It. Not sure this needed two cuts. Coming Home should have at least been one of them. Next is the King Curtis track Teasin', and the side ends with Blues Power, no intro. Then side four is all Derek and the Dominoes. First is the withdrawn single version of Tell the Truth. Then they include one of the jams recorded during the sessions, this one on Tell the Truth, so they call it Tell the Truth Jam. Then they end it with Layla, which gave them the excuse for the single release. The album also did very well, making it all the way up to number six. It seemed audiences were missing Slowhand. Then a label change sparked even more releases. Polydor went in and licensed Eric back catalog, so they released their own greatest hits package, this one called Eric Clapton at His Best. Since this was released at the same time as Heavy Cream, this one concentrated on Blind Faith, the solo album Derek and the Dominoes, but no Delaney and Bonnie since those recordings were still with ATCO. It's a bit of a dartboard album, no real rhyme or reason to what was chosen or how they were arranged. This one didn't sell quite as well, making it to number 87. Meanwhile, Eric's addiction was bothering his friends in the business. He did some interviews for the upcoming Jimi Hendrix documentary, and he looked very pale and spaced out. They thought maybe getting him back out on the stage would snap him out of it. Bit naive when you look back at it, but their hearts were in the right place. It would be at the Rainbow Theater in London and an all-star lineup. Pete Townsend, who came up with the idea, Steve Winwood, Ron Wood, Rick Gretsch, Jim Capaldi, Tulsa drummer Jim Karnstein, and Traffic percussionist Rebop Quackabah. Later in 1973, a six-song album came out from the show. They could have done a double album with the amount of songs that were done over the two shows, but they settled on a short six-song one. It had Badge, Roll It Over, and Presence of the Lord on side one, Pearly Queen, After Midnight, and Little Wing on side two. It sounds like Steve helped out on vocals for Badge and After Midnight, but it turns out Eric went back and overdubbed his own vocals, yet kept the originals. Shades of Mitch's drums on Angel. Not great, but it's actually a fun set. Right around the time of the Rainbow shows, Polydor put out a double album recorded during Derek and the Dominoes' 2 days at the Fillmore East in October 1970, titled In Concert. On production was a well-known name on this podcast, Eddie Kramer. Side one starts with a long version of Why Does Love Gotta Be So Sad? This one was over twice the length of the studio version, and unlike the original, this one's also drenched in wah-wah. Eric actually never used the pedal on the studio album, but was a prominent feature of the live shows. Next song was a surprise, a new one titled Got to Get Better in a Little While. They began playing this during the tour and even ended up doing it as part of the Johnny Cash performance, so it didn't make the show. By the way, Blues Power was the final song performed during the set, but also didn't make the show. This song may have been the centerpiece of the next album. They recorded a number of different versions. We'll talk about the songs released from the next album when we're done with the film and material. Side 2 started out with an epic rendition of Let It Rain, almost 18 minutes long. Sure, there's a 5-minute drum solo in there, but that leaves a lot of room for guitar solos. Most double live albums would have left that alone on the side, but they decided to stick one more song on here, a 6-minute version of Presence of the Lord. Eric does the vocals on his own song, and he does it a little behind the beat. Not the only time he'd do it on a song he'd done before. Side 3 kicks off with an 11.5-minute version of Tell the Truth. Basically, the studio version, just longer and a little more down-homey. Sometimes they do it a little differently, as we'll hear later. Bottle of Red Wine was next, same kind of thing, a longer, more intense version of the studio song. The fact that it was just Eric and Delaney worked well for Eric and Bobby. The side ends with Roll It Over. The Wah-Wah returns with a vengeance on this track. It's got a kind of sinister edge to it, but it brought the rare B-side fully into the Clapton catalog here. Side 4 is the blues side, a 10.5-minute version of Blues Power that goes right into an 8-minute Have You Ever Loved a Woman. If you're looking for an album where Eric just goes off and solos, then this album is for you. Within the context of these songs, it's like he takes you on a voyage with them. When I was building my Clapton collection in 1987, this album was only available on CD, and I didn't have one at that point. But just looking at the song lengths on the back cover made me really want this one. So for Christmas that year, I got my first CD player, and this was among my first 5 CDs. The other 4 were Dark Side, Wish You Were Here, duh. And 2 more Eric's, the Rainbow Show 6-song album, and Easy Was Here, the 1975 live album. Needless to say, when I plugged the player in and popped these discs in, I wasn't disappointed. That was all we heard from the concerts until 1988. On Crossroads, Bill Levinson included 2 more tracks from the run. First was a 6.5-minute version of Key to the Highway. This one's all Eric and solid from start to finish. The other is their version of Crossroads. It's a much slower arrangement, taking almost twice as long as the Cream version. He also does a similar thing to what he does on Presence of the Lord, which is singing behind the beat. He also throws in the Lemon verse from Traveling Riverside Blues that Led Zeppelin melded to their version of Killing Floor called The Lemon Song. Then over the summer, an issue of Guitar Player that focused on the box set and Eric's catalog as it existed on digital at the time, a floppy disk of Little Wing was included. This one was of interest since Bobby's organ dies about 2/3 of the way through, so it's just Eric, Jim, and Carl finishing the song. Then in 1994, as part of their vast reissue program, MCA released Live at the Fillmore, which took the songs from the shows and rearranged them into a concert set list. This would also include one unreleased track, Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out, and 3 alternate performances of Why Does Love Gotta Be So Sad, coming in at close to 15 minutes, Tell the Truth, where Eric does most of the solos on slide, and a nearly 20-minute Let It Rain, where Eric does some more soloing in and around the drum solo. The unfinished second LP also got songs released from the sessions. 5 of them were released on Crossroads. Then the same songs were included on the 40th anniversary set in different mixes. 2 of them were blues covers, a souped-up version of Howlin' Wolf's Evil and Mino Frisco, a song Eric returned to on Slow Hand in 1977. The originals included an instrumental called Snake Lake Blues, a dobro number called One More Chance, and the studio version of Got to Get Better in a Little While. The problem was Eric had only done vocals for the first and second verses. The 40th anniversary edition corrected this somewhat by having Bobby come in and do the vocals for the choruses and final verse. That set also included an additional instrumental jam on the song, and the soundtrack to Eric's bio, Life in 12 Bars, had the instrumental version of High from the Sessions, a song later done on There's One in Every Crowd. Layla and Other Sordid Love Songs is one of the seminal albums in rock history. It's received 2 different anniversary editions, as we've mentioned. The 20th was released in 1990, and it contained the album in a remixed form, a second disc with five long jams, including the Tell the Truth jam and the Killing Floor one with the Almonds, and a third disc of alternates that had the original and band versions of Mean Old World and the unfinished Tender Love, and some alternate takes of Have You Ever Loved a Woman, things like that. The 40th anniversary set was a monster. It had the album's original mix, a 5.1 version that included Mean Old World as the final track, a bonus disc with Mean Old World, the second album tracks, and the Johnny Cash appearance, but no Tender Love. It also had the original mixes of the In Concert album with four bonus tracks, Key to the Highway and Nobody Loves You When You're Down or Out on disc one, and Little Wing and Crossroads on disc two. The album's eventual success is largely credited to the interplay of Clapton and Duane Allman, and there's no doubt it's a vitally important moment in rock history. Rarely was Eric pushed the way he was when he was with Duane, and they both reached new heights in their playing. There was a reason people thought Derek stood for Duane and Eric. Duane usually had Dickey and the Allmans to continue pushing him to go further, but Eric rarely did after this, at least not for quite a while. But there was another driving force to the record, and that was Bobby Whitlock. He co-wrote a bulk of the album, and in the same way Duane pushed Eric's playing, Bobby helped push Eric's vocals to a new place, one he wouldn't return for quite a long while. Add into that Carl Radel's solid bass work and Jim Gord's percussion skills, and you have one of rock's crowning achievements. Unfortunately, as we mentioned, the band never played again after they broke up. When Eric talked about the album in the MTV rockumentary back in the late 80s, he was very happy to look at the album's inner sleeve, which was a photo montage of the band recording and doing all kind of goofy things. Then he ended with, "Two of these guys are dead. One's in the loony bin." The story doesn't end happily for three of the five band members. Duane Allman continued with the Allman Brothers, who struck gold with At Fillmore East. He was also a prolific session guitarist. In fact, one of the bands he helped was Delaney and Bonnie on their Motel Shot album, and he also ended up doing a radio appearance with them. His final session outside the Allman Brothers was for the band Cowboy and the song Please Be With Me, which Eric would cover a few years later. Almost a year after Layla came out, during the recording sessions for the Allman Brothers' next album, Eat a Peach, Duane died in a motorcycle accident at the age of 24. Eerily, the band's bass player, Barry Oakley, died almost exactly 1 year later at almost the exact same spot. I've come to consider the slide guitar part that Dickie Betts plays at the end of Ramblin' Man, Barry's last track, by the way, as sort of the ghost of Duane coming down, taking part in their biggest hit, and then saying, "Okay, you guys got this from here." Carl Radel got back in touch with Eric soon after he began recovery from heroin addiction and linked him up with a group of Tulsa musicians that would become his band through most of the 70s. They'd be with him on his comeback number one single, I Shot the Sheriff, the number one album, 461 Ocean Boulevard, and his later number two smash album, Slow Hand. Unfortunately, Eric fell back into alcohol addiction, and that didn't help Carl, who had his own issues with addiction. Eric fired the band and brought in a group of British musicians at the end of the 70s. Carl ended up succumbing to the effects of that lifestyle in 1980. Eric ended up regretting his treatment of the band and later worked with a number of them. Jim Gordon had been a prolific session drummer before Derek and the Dominoes and continued after the band broke up. He did memorable stints with Traffic, Steely Dan, and on the incredible Bongo Band's much-sampled cover of Apache. However, Jim had mental issues that grew more and more severe as the years progressed. He'd had violent outbursts as far back as the 60s. In 1983, he killed his mother, was convicted of murder, and sent to prison where he spent the rest of his life. He passed away a few weeks back in March of 2023. There's a track out there done around the time of the second album sessions with Eric, Jim, and Jim's wife at the time, Renee Armand, called Devil Road. It's on YouTube, and Renee has actually commented on the song and how it was recorded. Had the Dominoes done a full version of the song, it had the potential to be up there with tracks like Stairway, Low Sparkle, High Heel Boys, Funeral for a Friend, an epic mood track. Eric's playing on this is stunning. He goes places he hadn't gone before and never would again. It's similar to listening to Greg Allman's One More Try anthology. I swiped up a bunch of those before they went out of print. You can hear an artist's potential there in the music, and it's sad that it was never totally fulfilled. But thankfully, Bobby Whitlock is still with us and does occasional gigs with his wife, Coco. He did a couple albums after the Dominoes that were recorded in that era. I think it was Bobby Whitlock and Raw Velvet. By the end of the decade, he stepped away from the business and concentrated on his family. At the turn of the century, he began to reemerge. He finally played with Eric again in 2000 on Jules Holland's later program. It was good to hear him do the completion of Got to Get Better in a Little While, acknowledging his important contribution to the group. Eric stated a number of times he has no desire to go back to that material, so Bobby was the natural choice to do this. Clapton, however, did revive the song for live performances in the late 2000s, doing it a number of times. As for Eric, the Rainbow concerts didn't totally snap him out of his addiction funk, but it brought a spotlight to the problem. His girlfriend at the time, Alice Ormsby Gore, was also in the throes of addiction, so her father promised to get them both into treatment, provided once they finished, they broke up. They did, and Clapton began to work his way back into the business in 1974. As mentioned, that year brought a number one album and single. From there, Eric had a run of success, several bouts with alcoholism, a marriage to Layla herself, Patty Boyd, after she and George divorced, of course. But that one ended in divorce as well when Eric had a child out of wedlock. His son Connor was a source of light as he underwent treatment for alcohol in the late 80s and finally got clean. But tragedy struck again when the child fell out of an open window in 1991. People feared he would fall back into addiction, and thankfully he did not. He channeled his sorrow into songs, and a year later, Tears in Heaven almost topped the charts. This revival was further sparked by his appearance on MTV's Unplugged program. That album hit number one and won numerous Grammys, plus returned Layla to the charts in its stripped-down form. He's remained in the spotlight ever since, with several albums concentrating on the blues and hosting numerous benefit shows for his Crossroads Center for Addiction. He's had his moments of controversy, but has come through the other side, a little worse for wear, but still standing. His latest new-ish release, Lady in the Balcony, featured a couple songs dedicated to Fleetwood Mac founder Peter Green. And this month, he's doing a show in honor of his friend Jeff Beck. He's among the last men standing from that era. His Cream bandmates are gone. Rick Gresh, Delaney, Leon Russell, Joe Cocker, Three of the Dominoes, all the Almonds except Dickie and J-Mo. And unfortunately, we can add to the list Cream lyricist and Jack Bruce's writing partner, Pete Brown. And just the other day, Jimmy's former boss and Eric's duet partner, Tina Turner. As I often say, enjoy them while you can. One of the things Eric has done as he's remained in the business is continue to look back and not only respect his past, but to move things forward. We mentioned about his tour with Steve Winwood that sort of was a happier ending to the Blind Faith era. He joined the Rolling Stones in 1989 a few times to play Little Red Rooster, one of which I was lucky to see at Shea Stadium. That harkened back to the Howlin' Wolf sessions. Though Eric never got to play with Duane again, he did end up joining the Almonds for a couple days of their annual stand at the Beacon Theater in New York in 2009. Over the 2 days, they played Key to the Highway, Dreams, Stormy Monday, Why Does Love Gotta Be So Sad, Any Day, Little Wing, In Memory of Elizabeth Reed, and of course, Layla. The band has these for sale on their site, plus they're out there. They're definitely worth searching out. Eric and Derek Trucks, how funny is that to say together, have also played a number of times together. And a year or so ago, Derek and his wife Sue Tedeschi covered the entire Layla album with their band. But actually, my favorite little moment of Eric remembering his past is during the 1990 show at Nebworth. Eric is there with his touring band for Journeyman, and they were joined by Elton John. They ended with his usual set closer of that era, Sunshine of Your Love. But when they get to the solo section, instead of the Blue Moon sounding solo, Eric does something different. Elton John looks him with this look of utter confusion, like, what are you doing? And Eric just has this huge grin on his face, and it just so happened it was the same grin I had, because I'm like, he's doing Strangers in the Night. He's doing Jimmy's Wild Thing solo. All those years later, Jimmy left his mark on Eric, and he wasn't going to let it go away. Before we go, speaking of survivors, it was Steve Winwood's 75th birthday last month, so happy birthday to Steve. I think he's still in Nashville. He's either in Nashville or in Ireland. It's like one of the other. It's like you see him on one video, he's hanging around Nashville, and then the other place is somewhere in the, you know, Highlands somewhere. Yeah, like I mentioned, we're going to do a whole episode on the guys in Traffic since they were so intertwined with Jimmy, especially on Electric Ladyland. And, of course, Steve will be a prominent part of that. So he's another guy that has made it through. You know, he had his high period, then came down, kind of settled in. So I hope he's enjoying life and everything. Of course, looking forward to more music from him. I think he's still doing stuff. So looking forward to that. Wow, that was a lot, wasn't it? Only meant to do an hour or so of this. We'll do a few more of these from time to time. Probably we'll wait until at least the end of the year for the Traffic show. Maybe that'll slide to next year. We'll see how it goes. Next time, we'll move back to Jimmy. I have a couple ideas, but it'll depend on how much time I have to set aside for it. So let's leave it as a surprise. Please hit the subscribe button if you like what you're hearing. I'm John Hartshaw. Thanks for listening to this whole epic. Hi, I'm back. Okay, instead of waiting a whole month, a Layla recording date update. Remember the thing I said about it being recorded in the order it was released or vice versa? Well, that's not quite true. The issue has always been that Dwayne isn't on the first three tracks, so that would make sense. Dwayne didn't join until later, and so he missed the first three tracks. But that's not the case. There are a few times where songs are in a row that they were done on the album, plus the October sessions did overdubs. I recently dug my 20th anniversary set out of storage. I should have cracked it open and double-checked the whole Keep On Growing issue, as well as some other dates. So here are the correct dates for almost everything on the album. The Allman Brothers concert that Eric and Tom Dowd went to was on August 26th. The Killing Floor jam took place in the AM hours of the 27th. On August 28th, they did Tell the Truth. Makes sense that they'd already done that one. The Key to the Highway jam took place on August 30th. On the 31st, they did Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out, and Why Does Love Gotta Be So Sad? Then it appears Dwayne left for a couple of days, and they did Keep On Growing on September 1st. On September 2nd, they did one of the long jams on the box, and Dwayne wasn't on that, so it makes sense. Then they did I Looked Away and Bell Bottom Blues, as well as Have You Ever Loved a Woman? But Dwayne's on that last one. I think I remember a story now where Dwayne came back late into that session. It might have been an overdub, but it's kind of too tightly done for that to like leave a space for like, oh, okay, this is where Dwayne's going to do his thing. You know, doesn't make sense. They were pretty busy on September 3rd. They did I Am Yours Any Day and It's Too Late. They took a week off, and then on September 9th, they came back and did Little Wing and Layla. Now, I don't have the dates in front of me now for Thorn Tree in the Garden and Mean Old World. I think I remember Thorn Tree being done at the end of the October overdub sessions. Then considering they did both band and duo versions of Mean Old World, I'm pretty sure those were done in September. Those two, I'll double check and have for you next month. We try to get things right here, so thanks to the gang over at the Hoffman Boys. The Clapton Gang is a different crew than the Hendrix Group, though Purple Jam and Michael from Down Under, aka Hold Down the Line, hang out in those threads as well. The Estimable Rose River Bear does these intense song-by-song album breakdown threads where he tells you about chord changes and tempo changes. I mean, the works musically, it's, you know, deep in theory. We started doing Layla this morning and the Missing Dwayne issue came up. After a few of us, including myself, chimed in about the recording and order story, a couple of the other guys dug out the boxes, you know, 20th and 40th. They looked up the dates and they posted those. So thanks to the gang over there for keeping us in line.